Dr. Barbara Gittenstein, Dr. Kim Benston, thank you for joining us on NewsWorks tonight.
It's a pleasure to be here.
The study focused on presidents' attitudes on three topics. And one is financial sustainability. The other is the issue of college rankings and then student outcomes. The college rankings, it seems like everybody's got a poll now. Everybody's got something.
And almost all of them are what I call beauty contests. And I'm speaking from the perspective of an institution that does very well in those beauty contests. There are, however, some rankings that I think if you look at carefully, you can at least glean some useful data for the institution to go in the right direction. And for the most part, it's those rankings that help you look at outcomes, because that's where I think we're having the most problem in higher education. And if you look at the rankings, too, the worst of the beauty contests look only at inputs. That is, how good are the students when they come in? How big is your endowment? Those kinds of things. That doesn't really assess what you do while you're there, or what happens to the student. How far does the student get? I think the area that higher education still struggles in is learning outcomes assessment. We've just not gotten very sophisticated about that.
The individual tracks of data can be illuminating. Private rating systems are an industry, and they are here to stay, and people like Barbara and I have to, in some sense, manage expectations without ourselves being caught up in managing our educational missions to the rankings. That would be a severe error.
If we could turn to the financial outlook for our higher education system, I mean, before the recession, colleges felt pretty at ease with their tuition increases. They were usually outpacing the rate of inflation. And then the recession hit, and colleges still had the need to raise funds. So what's the financial outlook now?
A lot of the literature talks about the tuition increase year to year without taking into account what's happened to family income. And that is, actually, family income has stagnated since about 2002. And so even before the recession, families were suffering. So what was happening is that whether you're talking about a private institution or a public institution, tuition costs and fees for students were eating up a larger portion of a family's annual income. And now we've hit a crisis with that. So I think that's part of the conversation that has to happen on campuses. And I think part of the president's job is to help the campus understand this is just not a viable way to continue, that if you've got a need, that you have to sometimes substitute, more often substitute than simply add. And that's a hard conversation on a college campus.
Oh, yeah, it is. Sustainability, that's not a word perhaps that was used as often within administrations of colleges and universities as it now is and ought to be. And it's not simply an immediate phenomenon. It's been a growing and emergent one. We live in a culture in which the divide in wealth and in earning has grown greater and greater, and that has an immediately mappable impact on our missions. We also provide a particular kind of service, and when we look at the nature of that service and the opportunities for productivity and efficiency, they aren't the same as they might be if we were manufacturing widgets or selling hamburgers. We have a completely different business model, as it were. We also have to keep our eye on our core missions, understanding what is our core mission and what we will sacrifice and what we cannot afford to sacrifice without losing contact with what we're trying to do and who we're trying to serve. But it is navigable, and I think that we are beginning to learn the tools for doing that in an era where we aren't going to have tuition increases of the sort that we saw in the 90s, for example.
And I think actually the biggest problem for higher education right now is not the economic problem. I think the biggest problem is the suspicion and skepticism of the public and public leaders about higher education.
Yes.
And some of the solutions that are being proposed by politicians, particularly focusing on online education,
right,
focusing on competency-based education, focusing right on community colleges, will drive those students with the greatest need financially to those choices and by definition make them less employable than those who go to the four-year
right
colleges.
Right.
And
so
certainly over time, less employable.
It's a strangely elitist, it'll have a strangely elitist and classist effect.
That's
in
exactly
the name
right
of the opposite. But our successes over the course of a lifetime are demonstrably and empirically outstanding in the liberal arts sphere. I don't mean just Haverford College. And that's the kind of thing that in the kind of panic of the moment, which is an understandable panic in the aftermath of the meltdown in 2008, 2009, people are worried about the simple act of employment, but you're not really taking into account the aim of our educational mission, which is a full lifetime success.
Now, Barbara, you mentioned just a little while ago, just made a quick reference to doing things online. And I think technology could be seen as kind of a double-edged sword where it can streamline some things, but then it's also kind of, in a way, devaluing education. It makes it sound so easy, an online degree. You don't even have to leave your den.
What's being delivered at some institutions, as we are privileged to be part of, is so much different from what you get from any even excellent online experience. What's happening at the College of New Jersey, and I would suspect similar things are happening at Haverford, is what we call blended learning. And so what that means is a certain aspect of the course is delivered online or electronically or without face-to-face communication, and the rest of it is done face-to-face. And what that allows is, particularly in the summertime, let's say, for students to have jobs or other internships, because they can do the rest of the work for a portion of the summer electronically. I think also what electronic skills development courses allow is for those students who are at different levels with regard to their skills attainment to catch up to speed without slowing down a whole class, so that when the professor is in the classroom with the students, it's really rich time.
So right? The expensive aspects of education don't have to be sacrificed.
Correct.
Yeah. So I think one of the key things in what Barbara is saying is that these technological modalities that are emerging every day are potentially, if harnessed correctly and carefully, are strong enhancements of the project of intimate and personal education that both of our institutions are engaged in. But I think that it can be a little bit misleading to too quickly and too glibly to imagine this to be a panacea or for cost containment. It's a containment in the sense that you can do certain kinds of things that, again, advance the core educational mode through the use of technology in concert with traditional modes of face-to-face education. But the replacement of one by the other, which is happening in some institutions or being experimented with, is not what I think we're talking about. The other thing to note is that as educational institutions, we tend to be at the front line of what technological innovation is about, which means that we're not necessarily dealing with already fully understood technological modes, and it means that we're not sort of applying an already packaged out-of-the-box technology within the site that we're operating in. We are molding technological opportunity around the classroom, around field work, around the laboratory, putting ourselves in touch globally with other classrooms, enhancing opportunities that actually didn't exist 10 or 15 years ago, in one sense expanding at relatively low cost the opportunities for educational conversation. But that's not the same thing as replacing and thereby simply radically reducing cost.
I think that's absolutely right. And one of the things to keep in mind is that if you're doing this technology really well, it's not cheap.
It's not cheap.
It's very expensive.
How about a personal viewpoint? For each of you at your individual institution, what's the greatest challenge you feel that lies ahead in the next few years and maybe a good success that you've had recently?
As the president of a institution where most of the students are traditional underage, which of course is not traditional anymore, but 18 to 22, I think every president in that circumstance worries first about how these students develop in their lives as they're dealing with some of these new challenges, either intellectually or socially. And part of the reason that I'm worried about it more today than I have been in the past is that there is indication that students of today are not as resilient as the students of 10 and 15 years ago were. So how are they going to be dealing with some of these challenges that will only speed up? These changes are only going to speed up in our world. And how do we help prepare them? So I think what we've been doing at the College of New Jersey to try to address that is to make sure that we are better coordinating what's happening in the classroom with what's happening outside of the classroom. And we all talk about integrating academic affairs and student affairs, but I think we, in the last 2 years, have been focusing on that much more intensively. And you have to have the right person, a chief student affairs officer, and the right chief academic officer to get it to happen, because students don't experience their lives on a campus as either in the classroom or outside of the classroom. They just are at college or at a university. And I think we have to develop programs that help them in both settings develop these other skills, most of which used to be considered mm-hmm. in the purview of student affairs.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And how about Haverford?
Yeah, well, we occupy the same cultural landscapes. So Barbara has spoken very well to my own thoughts. I think the students, in addition to being perhaps a little more fragile. Another way of putting that is that they've been trained to be risk averse. They've come through an educational system that is more pinched than the one that their predecessors grew up in. This has all to do with other conversations going on that are cognate with the ones we're having about what education should do and what I would call the instrumentalizing of education, the test mania that we have already, at least a national conversation about. Our students are wonderfully creative against that background, but they still have perhaps a little bit more developed sense of what they already want to be, which can sometimes narrow their engagement with the vast opportunities of the liberal arts experience. One of our approaches to that has been to create co-curricular mechanisms and entities such as centers across our divisions, science, social sciences, and humanities, that work in tandem with the curriculum to open up opportunities for students to, in a sense, breathe intellectually and creatively, to connect their classroom experience, to work in the community, to work in the field, to their own projects, to give them a great deal of ownership and agency in their education so that they begin to take hold of all of those innate powers that they really do have and don't narrow them themselves faster than they should before they know fully how to use them. If they can do that and take full advantage of the 4 years opportunity that they have at a Haverford or TGNJ, they will be ready for the world. It's going to be, as Barbara said, changing not only quickly but more quickly at new modes of speed and be able to be creative change makers, leaders, and citizens.
Yeah. Dr. Barbara Gittenstein, Dr. Kim Benston, thank you for coming on NewsWorks tonight.
Appreciate the opportunity.